J. Faulkner, and now Living Writers.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on Living Writers, we have a conversation with Gerald Visenor, taped last week in the studio when Gerald Visenor was in town to present the 2018 Burkhofer Jr. Lecture, Betrayal and Irony, Native American Survivance, and the Subversion of Ethnology. Gerald Visenor is a professor emeritus of American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He is a citizen of the White Earth Nation in Minnesota and has published more than 30 books, including novels, literary criticism, cultural studies, and poetry. Visenor has received many awards, including the American Book Award for Griever, An American Monkey King in China, the Western Literature Association Distinguished Achievement Award, and the Lifetime Literary Achievement Award from the Native Writers Circle of the Americas. He lives in Naples, Florida. Today, we talk about his early life, knowing that writing would be important to him early on, about his long career, his continuing work, and about chance. Hope you enjoy today's program with Gerald Visenor.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling.
I just graduated from college, and there weren't any jobs. This is 1960, and no employment. But I did pass a state civil service exam, and then with that, ranking high and with veterans' preference, they had to interview me. So the only jobs open were in corrections, either juvenile, probation, or working in the institutions. And there was a job I wanted on the reservation, which was a social worker in Cass County in Walker, Minnesota. But they rejected me because I was Native and they thought I had too many relatives in the neighborhood.
And then you would...
That would be a nice lawsuit today, but at the time it's the way things were.
Right, right.
And then the State Reformatory in St. Cloud finally hired me and discovered that two of my uncles had been in there, and I never knew that. It was a family secret. They were both in at the same time for 1 year.
Were these your dad's brothers?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the file, I found letters from my father and my grandmother, and it was quite touching. How I got there so that I could read that case file is quite amazing.
But it was meant to be, in a way.
No.
No?
I choose chance. Chance has... connections and relationships. It's not causal, but there are other chances that it might have worked out in different ways, and this one was very unusual.
That's so hopeful, too, to say there's other chances that might work out in other ways, so it doesn't have to feel so locked down as this meant-to-be thing that I said. So this the element of chance and the trickster.
Yeah. Well, the head of the security there, the head guard, he was head then, but he remembered my two uncles because he had just started as a guard. That would have been almost 30 years earlier. And he spoke of them as good boys, and they were good enough that they put them out on the farm, which was minimal security, and they worked on the farm for 1 year and were released.
How old were
they? These were minimal crimes.
They
were 18 and 19.
Was it stealing cars? Was that?
No. One stole what the equivalent of a six-pack of beer, and the other one was convicted of what was said then as carnal knowledge.
What?
Meaning he had a love affair with the person he was in love with, and somebody didn't like the fact that he was Indian.
Right. That's, you know, because this is an interior landscape.
Yes.
Your autobiographical myths and metaphors.
There was a scene that I was particularly touched by. My grandmother deliberately took the family dog named Timmy to the reformatory, to the prison, and accidentally, of course, left the dog behind. And the warden writes to say, sorry, we have a policy of no pets. And she apologized in a letter and said they searched and searched for him. And I could tell from the tone of her letter she was totally manipulating his sympathies for the dog. And he wrote back and said, well, yes, as long as the next time you visit, you take the dog back. Well, there were three letters where she didn't take the dog back, and he was getting more insistent. However, the last letter he said, I've decided to make an exception to the rule. The inmates are so happy with Timmy, and he has adjusted so well to the farm that we've allowed him to stay. And then several years later, there was a letter that he wrote to my grandmother announcing the death of Timmy, and it started out, I regret to inform you, Mrs. Alice Beaulieu, that your dog Timmy has died yesterday, and we buried him on the hill overlooking the farm.
That's a beautiful story. Timmy. So Timmy stayed on once your uncles left, because that had become his new home and sort of his calling in a way.
They didn't want to go to the city and become painters, house painters. That's what they did.
And then two of your other uncles, you found out they had been in World War I, and you wrote the historical novel.
They were great-uncles,
great-uncles. Because they were Native Americans fighting in World War I.
Yes.
And you wrote a historical novel called Blue Ravens about this.
Yes, that information was difficult to find. I mean, it's no surprise, of course, that Natives are not included in much American or world history, unless it's the history of imperial dominance or colonial dominance or victimry. And in this instance, I wanted to put Natives back into the history of the First World War because there was very little written about the subject. Some very good academic studies, two books, very good, completely different, but very focused and not on the soldiers, but more on the institution of the military and the drafting and stuff like that. So I wanted to make it a historical novel. Now, I say historical novel in this sense that the framework, the characters, the events, the units, training, all of that is historically researched. And I place, and my family, my members of my family served in those units, but their experiences I have to imagine. And I do that through diaries of soldiers who served in those very same units so that I could even have sometimes the description of the weather. For instance, when Lawrence Visnor was killed in action on October 8th, 1919, just 5 weeks before the end of the armistice, he was in a place called Montbrillant. He was an American assigned with other Americans to serve with the British military advancing on the Hindenburg Line, which is sort of northeast of Paris, and he was killed on early that morning. So I went to the place, of course, and went on the same day and wanted to feel the weather. But I didn't know what the weather was at the time of his death. But when I visited, it was foggy, kind of chilly, misty, low visibility. And later I found a diary published online by an aviator. This was the beginning of aviation. And he wrote in his diary that October 8th, I could not fly today because it was overcast, hazy, cold, and misty. Exactly the same weather that I experienced when I visited.
So you went to feel the weather, to feel the place itself. What else did you feel there?
Well, there are cemeteries everywhere, so you can't escape the desperate voices in the air of this horror. I couldn't understand how people could continue living there, but to be just immune to it. Cemeteries on every hillside. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people killed, soldiers. And the British and Americans were very dedicated to maintaining monuments and gravestones and an actual record. So you're in the presence, as I refer to it in my own memory, of thousands and thousands of voices that ended there. And I tried to keep that in mind when I was writing. I could imagine myself in the place again as I started to write. It's not so difficult to imagine the sound of war. In the military, I was part of all kinds of exercises, not actual life and death combat, but training for it. And so the sounds are familiar.
And this is when you were 18 years old, mm-hmm. and you were in the service.
Yes.
And you were assigned to Japan.
Yes, by chance. I was on a ship with 3,500 of us who had been trained at various camps. And then the training was quite long. It was 16 weeks of extensive military training, killer training. So we were to be sent on this huge advance in Korea, you know, the MacArthur advance. But the hospital ship was taking so many casualties in Incheon Harbor, and it was a narrow harbor that the troop ship couldn't move in. So they started flying two plane loads of soldiers over from Yokohama in Japan. And they got to the middle of the T's and stopped mysteriously. And rumors were floating. Of course, the one that always surfaced in the military whenever there was an unknown, we're going to Hawaii. It was like vacation fantasy. And always, if there was something unknown, someone would suggest Hawaii is the place we're going.
Why not?
And so we were put on trains and sent to Hokkaido to train with a tank, a battalion, and return to Korea. But by the time we completed our training, the truce had been agreed to, and I didn't have to go. So my service continued in Japan.
In Japan, that's where you found a connection to haiku.
Oh, did I ever? I mean, talk about chance, right? I mean,
an understatement.
Yeah. I suppose I might have found literature in Korea, too, but it would have been much more difficult.
Ooh. I love the sound of that.
No, what just amazed me, I mean, I still remember how both impressed and astounded to find that in ordinary Japanese homes, I don't know what an ordinary home is, but the homes I did visit, friends I made, they had scrolls of famous Japanese haiku poets and calligraphy on their walls. And I thought, this is unbelievable. There isn't an American literature like that. Who would know? Most of it is celebrated as foreign literature. I mean, Shakespeare, Chaucer, Milton. I mean, well, Milton's half and half, but... But, you know, was Faulkner quoted on the walls of no. And so it.
Maybe a few dorm walls.
Maybe, or at least his picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So it really put me in the context of serious literary thoughts when I wasn't expecting it. I had no idea about this. I kind of had a notion that writing would be a good idea for me because I, at age 13, observed a journalist writing about a small accident in the neighborhood. And I was really intrigued by this guy who had this narrow notebook and walked around talking to people. And I thought, ooh, what kind of job is that? And when I learned what it was, that's what I wanted to be.
And you did that too.
But first I had to deliver papers first. No, I'm joking. It was cause and effect. But
you did though.
I did, yeah.
And you were very young when you were you 13
young.
Or were
yeah,
you younger?
13.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I delivered for one paper, but I knew they wouldn't probably hire me, the Minneapolis Star and Tribune, directly. But
they
bought out the time. No, this right. was the Minneapolis Times. And the Tribune bought out the Times, and I was one of the Times delivery boys. So without interviewing me, they just continued my route with a different newspaper. So otherwise, chance again. Yeah. I doubt very much if they'd hired me. I was too much trouble. And
I don't believe it.
Yes. And I'm not criminal trouble, but too much trouble. But that was great. I did that for a couple of years. And little did I know, 20-some years later, I'd end up as a journalist for the Minneapolis Tribune.
And so it's almost as if you had, like, when you were 13, that was almost a vision of what, something you knew you wanted, or you felt a kinship with it.
Well, I felt the writing part Yeah. I got familiar with the idea of writing rather than just journalism. And but you understand, I have a minimal grasp of grammar. At that time, because I didn't like school very much, and my English teachers didn't like me because they didn't like the things I wrote because they didn't believe them, but they were all from my experience. I had complicated experiences. I mean, I joined the National Guard when I was 15.
You lied about your age to do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, how they would believe me,
I
don't know.
That,
because I look at 15-year-olds and I couldn't believe that I would have done that. But in fact, there was a time when I doubted my own story. That I thought, you know, this happens. You can, you know, inadvertently.
Oh, in your own, yeah.
Yeah, my own story. And so I actually had to go consult my own discharge from the Minnesota National Guard to confirm that I was indeed 15 years old. And, but then Korea started the war, and I'd been in a year. And it turns out they knew exactly I was underage, but they let me in anyway. I guess they admired my ambition. Mm. And they made an offer. You can go with us, or you can take an honorable discharge as underage. I took a couple of weeks, actually. I actually thought about going, but I realized this was a chance that, you know, one of these chance connections. I already had an appreciation for chance. But you have to create experiences to even discover chance. This one seemed wisely too risky, and the unknowns were too dramatic. A failure was much too threatening, so I didn't. But 2 years later, I enlisted as soon as I was 18.
And that's when you went to Japan.
Yeah. But they were still fighting that thing. Can you imagine that after all that time?
Like, I can. The U.S. history, we seem to be no stranger to long wars.
We have a history of war for young people.
And with everyone. And well, there's so many things to talk with you about, Jared.
Yeah, I guess we better get to literature. Oh, wait, here's the connection.
Yes,
haiku. And I was so appreciative of this. And they could quote these things, and I couldn't quote anything. Oh, well, I discovered, yes, I could remember some dream songs, but they were in stories from, you know, my family and others. And I could appreciate that, and I started to put that together, that there actually here are some similarities in this concise imagery and dream songs. It was later in studying it that, you know, I could observe differences, but still the similarities prevail.
And would that be the moment, like being in the moment? And
what haiku interpreters like Yasuda would say would be a haiku moment. It's an instant perception where the words don't describe things. The words are the thing or the experience. And that's a feeling of native dream songs. They're, of course, highly poetic. The differences are quite often pronouns, first and first-person pronouns are used in some of the dream songs. Not a lot, but for instance, I am as beautiful as the roses. Mm. And it's a ironic, beautifully ironic dream song because the woman who sang it from Red Lake was recorded by Frances Densmore, a musicologist. Oh. And she told a little story about the actual recording that this woman was about the ugliest woman she'd ever seen in her life singing this beautiful song.
And her voice was so beautiful.
Yes. And then with it is this drawing called the song picture. I call it a pictomyth, rather, because it's a picture of a mythic song. And the idea was you could show these drawings to people in different places and communities of the same language, and very likely they would recognize the song by the image or the pictomyth. And sure enough, people were singing, "I am as beautiful as the roses." Some of them not knowing, probably, especially after a generation, not knowing that this was sung by someone who had aspirations to be beautiful but wasn't quite there.
And so she was the originator of the song, the creator
yes.
of the song.
Yes, she was. But it lasted way past her. It was a very lovely, beautiful song, repetitive parts of it. So you can see the imagistic interest there. And then the fact that there was a picture that would be a visual reference to remember both some rhythm and the image of the song. So those things were fascinating and exciting, and I grew in that consideration of music and images, and just matured in it and studied a lot later and started writing my own.
And when you were away, you were far from home and from right. where you grew mm-hmm. up, and was it some way of also bringing home closer to you, like the images of home? Because did you begin writing when you were there, when you were 18?
I did, yes. I was writing short stories and just started to write, I should say maybe imitate haiku, yeah.
But were you going to images of your own, or were you writing about Japan around you?
Okay. Yeah, my own experiences.
So that's something that, because there's some quality with, I feel like, haiku and dream songs, where they feel like, that's why I was almost surprised when you said that she had started this song, because they almost feel like they have no beginning or end.
Yes.
Or so, do you?
Yes. No, they do. They float. Yeah.
There was one line that I love to the sky loves to hear me sing.
Yes, that's really another one. Yes, related. Right. Yes, very arrogant, isn't it? But it's a lovely image. Well, you might say in response to that, because there was a lot of teasing too, cultural teasing, you might say to a song like that, "Well, I'm glad the sky does."
Yeah. Can you tell me more about teasing? Because I feel like this is something that's, it's a current throughout everything that you make, and it's like a way of being. It's not a philosophy. It's a way of being or living.
It's pretty risky today to tease, even in, you know, among family members. It's kind of risky. Identities are rather fixed and fragile at certain times. But I have to say, and I don't want to romanticize this at all, I grew up in a teasing family, and I know almost all natives in different ways, different cultural contexts, had experiences of teasing. It was in nicknames to start with, let's say. Example I've probably overused, but it is quite dramatic. It's a missionary translating a sacred name of a person, but got it wrong, thought the sacred name turned out actually to be a nickname. And the translation was "man afraid of his horse." His friends used that nickname with him, and he was a young person who actually was incredibly dynamic and fantastic on a horse. And his friends envied him and teased him as the man afraid of his horse. You know, it's a good way to level the arrogance of being so good at something. A common experience, I think, in a lot of families, you get a little too big in your britches and
take you down a peg
or right.
two.
Yeah, right. Then it's done through teasing. Little big man, you know, I mean, to mock the film title.
Yeah.
And title of the book, rather.
Well, but then the missionary actually thought that was his name.
Sacred name, yeah. Natives would rarely reveal a sacred name for translation because there wasn't a surname system. People were known by nicknames, and quite often several of them. And many of the nicknames would be teasing names. I don't want to say many. Frequently you'd find some teasing names. And not just for children, but, you know, throughout life, yeah. And this is a good example of one, because then it became a surname when the federal government set up reservations or forced people to reservations, and then schools, and then you have to have a surname. so this is a surname. Some of those family members abbreviated it to Mann, but many, the name still exists as a surname, Mann Afraid of His Horse, and the family certainly knows it was a nickname and it came from teasing, but who else would?
Right, right. You said you have many nicknames, right? Or were any of them sort of in this spirit or
It was
community?
More general teasing rather than a nickname.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was, and...
Military Pontiac. Oh. Pontiac was one, but, you know, that's hardly a tease. That's a...
That's kind of, would it be a stereotype?
It's weird, yeah,
so?
Right, yeah. I mean, I had the nose to satisfy it, but... Is that self-teasing or
or self-deprecation, okay. Or I don't know. I always say I've got the face and wardrobe for radio.
Oh, so, good.
So you had a sense from when you were 13 or so. There was something about like writing and wordplay.
Yeah, it seemed I suppose, I mean, you understand I have to go back to interpret this because I wasn't thinking right. Interpretively or critically.
Right, or how to tell your own story from
yeah,
that point
that's
on.
That's right. But it did, it appears to me, you know, later that it was a bit of a pleasure of liberty. This person could walk around and talk to people and mm-hmm. make notes and obviously and write things for newspapers. That seemed to be much better than a factory job or... something like that, or a house painter, which is what my family did.
So you became a journalist, and you were active during the Red Power years too.
Yes,
is that fair? Because
right.
That's something
Vietnam
Scott
War
had
and Red
told
Power
me.
Years, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you were someone who you were writing
yes.
about this specifically.
Mm-hmm. I wrote about it. I mean, a journalist. I'm not doing editorial. I'm writing about events. So I'm not critiquing it. But then I moved to editorial writing for the Tribune, and then I started writing critically of the American Indian movement. And, you know, that didn't end up to be a safe occupation, but I continued anyway. I considered most of the things they did as preposterous, and they would do things that had already been settled in federal courts. You know, make advances and confront people and institutions which had already been settled, you know, by young Native lawyers, you know. So it was a bit of a demonstration that was money-producing, fame-producing. When movie stars start praising you and sending you money and visiting you and writers from New York want to publish your book, you know, that's pretty critical stuff. And when people contribute money, funds, federal government and others start giving money to a movement like this, why not? You might say, I've never made more money than this. All they have to do is be a radical. I don't want to diminish this just as a show. But the leaders were... My critique of the American Indian Movement and some of the prominent leaders was that they discovered their radicalism in prison. Clyde Belcourt, Dennis Banks were in prison when they met. And I'm not faulting them for being good citizens when they come out of prison. But that doesn't make a leader. You see what I mean? And I would raise these questions. Are we so desperate that the only leaders we can find are people who are in prison? There are a lot of good people around who have done really great things for natives. And they don't ask for any appreciation, but they are, in fact, our leaders because they have a sense of ethos and a sense of courage, and they don't celebrate themselves. And they don't make a living off their ethos. They live by it. They don't make a living off of it. So I wasn't so popular. My friend said I don't suffer fools gladly, and I'd say you understate that.
I'm trying to be on my best behavior, Gerald.
Okay.
Well, one of the reasons why I did ask you too was because when I had had a couple of email exchanges with Scott and Joe,
yes.
They had said, ask Gerald about the contract.
Oh, very good.
I don't know
set up.
But I don't know.
Hey,
this is terrific.
So a little shout-out to Scott and Joe there.
That's good. The year I had to arm myself, right?
Yeah, so when would that have fit into this? Was this also in the 60s?
This was about 1969, I think, yeah. And there was a – I learned from Insider – this is early Native whistleblowers. I learned from the Inside that afternoon a contract had been placed on me at a meeting. So I didn't know about it for about a day.
Were you in – so you were in Minnesota then?
No, I was
then,
living in Bemidji then. I was teaching at the University in Bemidji, and I, at the time of the first threat, I was giving a lecture to high school teachers at a conference in Duluth. And I could tell by the way people walked in on both sides of the room that – they were curious about me. But anyway, that I got out of that, and then I had to decide how to protect myself without running away, and decided the best approach was to consult close friends to see how they dealt with these matters. And my closest friend, a lawyer who worked for the tribe, said, "Visnor, I know what you're thinking. You grew up in a kind of culture where you can kind of fight it out with words and, you know, that you know exactly when to tease or not and to kind of calm it down or create rage or however it works. You know how to do that. You grew up that way." And I said, "Yeah, that's right. That's still the way I feel." He said, "Well, you don't get it. You've already been displaced. Your method doesn't work anymore. These, many of them, are drug freaks. They're not going to be talking or listening." And he was absolutely right. And I said, "So what do you suggest?" And he said, "Arm yourself. This is a lawyer." And I said, "Well, you face a lot of people like this." And he said, "I've been armed for something like 3 or 4 years. I didn't believe him, but sure enough, he was.
So you had to, and then would you wear like a bulletproof vest?
Or no. I just carried a pistol. But I had to go through all the things about it because since the military, I didn't want anything to do with weapons. I wasn't a hunter. I couldn't kill things, couldn't kill animals. And,
you're a poet.
Not that I faulted people who felt they had to live by that, but I couldn't accept it and didn't want to talk about it. It was a life I thought was unnecessary, was long gone, and we had a terrible burden already trying to solve the horrors of the fur trade, killing off dozens and dozens, near extinction, of totemic animals that were part of our very visions. How anyone can do that, just as an act of survival, I don't say survivance there, no. I say survival,
yeah.
Escapes me,
or
I can't fault several generations ago. Whatever they did was complicated, and they have their own burdens to explain that, except it's now our legacy. And I have to intellectually deal with it, emotionally deal with it, but I'm not going to arm myself, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be a hunter or something. But I went to the sheriff and talked to him about it, the county sheriff, and he told me the county law was that I could carry a firearm by notifying him, but it would have to be exposed, opposite to the concealed carry.
Right.
And I said, "Well, what if it's kind of half exposed occasionally?" And he said, "Well, I can't answer that, but it doesn't sound like that would be much of a violation."
It also seems like a different time then, too.
Very different
it?
Time. It was a bit complicated because I'd be in Minneapolis quite often attending meetings and had to go through about 4 counties to get there. And they each had different laws, but Hennepin County, Minneapolis, was locked in a case, and that was easy. I just bought a small attaché case. But it wasn't just being armed. What I'm getting to is I had to have an ideology. I had to have a philosophy that I'm bigger and stronger than you are. I have more power. I'm better trained. I'm smarter. You can't get away with the stupid threats you've just made. And I just started lecturing that way. It's what you call a Cold War. He says it was a Red War, a Red Cold War. And I felt good about it. I said, some drug freak who thinks he's going to take me down because of what I write about natives is going to pay a heavy price. It's a risky, but it was, I thought, necessary. And I have to say it worked.
Yeah, you got through it.
I did, yeah.
And probably you also heard a lot of support from people so that...
Yeah. Remember, a lot of people went missing and dead during that. I shouldn't say a lot. There were several murders. One, two or three in South Dakota during the... You know, this was a serious time. And I didn't want to be one of the casualties of this. I mean, I wasn't an informer. I mean, and it's... The theory is that the people were killed who were informers. That's a theory. It hadn't been really proven. But I had a different fear. I mean, I am not going to stop writing. Then I was even more critical. What I didn't do, though, and I'm not sure how anyone would respond to this, what I didn't do is write about their drug use. It seemed much too complicated because loads of white people were on drugs too. And it was pretty serious then, not nearly as serious as it's become and it is now.
With the opioid crisis.
Yeah. And this was mostly experimental cocaine, but a lot of marijuana. It wasn't opioids and it wasn't fentanyl. It wasn't the designer drugs. And it wasn't heroin yet. Occasionally, but mostly it was cocaine. But there was quite a bit of use among American Indian movement, and they always had their stashes, and they always had their use of it. But I decided not to write about it. It was, to me, not the issue. The issue was ideology and leadership. And this felt to me to be... I can't say weakness because so many people were doing it. Mm. And I don't know how it satisfied them. If it calmed them down, I'm afraid I'd say, good for you. But I don't know that.
Right.
In other words, I
can't know.
Couldn't understand it. But so I dealt only with the ideology and their actions. I did what a journalist did. I wrote their actions, the events, and the consequences. And I didn't go into personal behavior or their women or their abuses of women or their use of drugs.
So we've been talking about your time as a journalist, but you also have spent such a part of your life in the classroom.
Yes.
And you mentioned being at a conference and then being... And it seems like haiku is another connection here, because is it fair to say that's how you got your first college job, was because
yes.
of haiku?
Oh, this is a very nice transition, because it contains all three of the things we've just been talking about. Oh, perfect. And we didn't even rehearse this.
Look at us. Chance can be kind sometimes.
Yes, it can, yeah. Well, if you choose it rightly. Yes, I met a fellow who was on, Jerry Gerasimo, was on sabbatical leave from Lake Forest College, just north of Chicago, private college, very good one. And he was trying to persuade me, once we became friends, to come teach there. And I said, no, I'm a writer, I'm not a teacher. But he succeeded. And so I went for an interview after submitting everything. And I met with the chair at a dinner party at his house with half a dozen faculty members. And the chair was a wonderful person, and he drank heavily. He liked gin. And the faculty fled. What I didn't know is that they were going to plan a party because they expected he'd offer me a job. And so he started asking the ritual questions, and I was prepared. I was prepared to talk about social sciences and lots of rubbish, and methods and theories and stuff as best I could, enough to say I could handle a classroom. Mm. And he hammered the table and shouted at me, "Shut up! You think I invited you here to talk about that rubbish?" I invited you here to hire you because you write haiku. Let's talk about haiku. And that was the job. And I said, well, why didn't you say so?
Right.
So my first teaching job was, I had done some visiting teaching, you know, like one course a semester at a couple mm-hmm. of colleges in Minneapolis on certain subjects, but this was full time. Now, I was happy to leave the street, so I took leave from the Minneapolis Tribune mm-hmm. and the threats of AIM and went to Lake Forest. And half of my classes, seminar style, they didn't have large classes. People were missing, and I didn't inquire. And, of course, they were taking drugs because these are a lot of pretty nice people who, you know, have pretty good income families that can afford to send them to a really good college. And so they have a lot of spending money. And I couldn't get adjusted to this very well, so I just concentrated on the students who were there. And I just kind of made my way through without critique because it wasn't something I could change.
But that's why you left there.
Yeah. Well, then the president, this goes to drugs again, the president, sent out a second-year contract, and I ignored it. Well, I mean, if I'm not going to take it, I don't answer, right? So he called me by phone and said, come see me, and I did. And he said, why didn't you answer my offer? And I said, because I'm not returning it. I thought that should be clear enough. And he said, why not? He was a young new president. And I said, because of the drug problem. Well, I said that in a rage. I said, are you so stupid? And then he said, what drug problem? I misinterpreted
the wrong thing to say exactly.
Well, it was, but for a different reason, as you'll see. I misinterpreted the context of his saying, what drug problem? He meant
which
faculty
which
or
one?
Student.
Yeah.
And then I apologized and said, well, those are double reasons then that I'm not returning. So I went back to journalism and then ended up at Bemidji State University.
And then out to
no
California.
No drug problem there that I could tell of, but anyway. Yeah, then California. Well, University of Minnesota, then California, yeah.
And so, and staying within academia for
yes, this I overlapped time. Careers for a while as an editorial writer. You know, I would write. I think I had a contract of one or two a month for the Minneapolis Tribune.
So you're teaching. You're also working in journalism, mm-hmm. but then also in your whole writing life, it's like haiku, screenplays, fiction, novels, theory. Epic poems, like the one that was performed here, mm-hmm. Bear Island, essays. You're a writer, and even pieces that are hybrid pieces, you do everything, Gerald.
Well, I look over the things I've done, and some of it I can't quite remember, and I wouldn't believe it if I were on the outside of it. It's too much. I don't remember how I... But I'm driven by idea, and it's exciting and troublesome and highly motivated, and I have to finish it. And
it's not finish it.
I have to get to it and work it out. Yeah.
Find it. Be mm-hmm. in it
yes.
a bit. And these are ideas that, well, how are they? Because you're dedicated to it, and you make the time. You don't let time get away from you, so you make this. Mm-hmm. How is it working now for you, Gerald? Like with the ideas and the
oh,
time?
Being retired
and Naples and working
yeah.
and
yeah. Well, the balmy weather is inspiring. I have to tell you, yeah, it's much better than fighting the cold.
Collecting shark teeth on the Gulf Coast,
something like that. Yes, I miss. Good seminar classroom. I don't want to say I don't miss lecturing. Not as much. It's very difficult, but in every classroom there's, you know, maybe a third really interested people, and it's such a rewarding, you know, mm-hmm. pleasure. And then of them, a few who just connect with certain ideas, and that's just That's a kind of educational ethos that's just spectacular. It's really memorable at the end of the day if that works. And it's a balance, you know. I have to say I was really fortunate. Some of it's by chance that I had good jobs. And I was a good teacher and active and did my duty as committee members and things. But these were good research universities that honored writers and you know, allowed that or encouraged that to happen. So
you could follow these ideas.
Yes, I could.
You could
and I could use
them.
A lot of ideas in the classroom. So it was, I wouldn't say interrelated, but it was inspiring.
Yes.
To be able to talk seriously in the context of literature about new ideas. And so, you know, it's not that things were worked out that way. It's just that it's an inspired way to discuss it and to see students struggle with it, which is my own learning then too, you see. So it was – it's not interrelated. It's a ethical experience that can't be duplicated easily. And I can't say I loved it because that suggests something sympathetic and romantic. I was totally involved in it. Mm-hmm. It was a way of life. I was honorable to it. I had an ethos of education and took it seriously. And if I were a politician, I would have governed in the same way.
Mm. What is the writing like now, Gerald, now?
It's... it seems to work out that I'm mature enough and experienced enough with so many ideas that I don't need the classroom. Or to put it another way, I don't need it as often. Say, preparing this lecture this evening was a wonderful way of thinking about ideas for an audience. It's partly a bit of teaching and trying to anticipate how ideas will be heard and to work it out carefully and try to measure the time and have some humor, you know, to really be part of the experience fully, not just to deliver something. And that's really gratifying, and I get just enough invitations so that I can do that. And this is a special one. I mean, the Burkhofer lecture is really extraordinary. What a great man, and I knew his work very early in the 70s. Let me put it this way. First starting out teaching in the 60s and 70s, there weren't a lot of books we could use. Now, there wasn't much in print. This wasn't yet a big subject. And university presses started reprinting a lot of things then. So it was just starting and, you know, and Burkhofer comes out with these fantastic, with this great book, you know, the and it was immediately necessary in the classroom. And I can't remember a student in all my time that ever resisted his good ideas. I'm just sorry I missed him. I was a student at the University of Minnesota and graduated a year before he, or maybe 2 years before he arrived. Then I came back to teach a year after he left. And he went to, I can't remember exactly where. Then I went to teach at Santa Cruz. And he arrived a year after I left and went to Berkeley.
Yeah. So many near misses then.
But I like to think we really would have liked each other because we ended up in the same places, except I've never been to Michigan, so except to lecture. Yeah. What a courageous, honorable book he did to critique the creation, the false creation through colonial interests and domination of an Indian, the white man's Indian. Just brilliant for us who were teaching because, I mean, obviously it would have taken any one of us, even if we were as smart as he was, years and years, decades to do that if we put our time to it, maybe longer. And here it was handed to us. A incredible gift of insight. And it made teaching so much easier and such a great pleasure to have his original, brilliant, honest, critical ideas.
Thank you for speaking about this, Gerald, because I haven't read his book, mm-hmm. and I need to. I know the name of the lecture, and I know it's...
You will truly love this text, yeah.
Well,
I don't use love. It's
important.
Cliche, but
it's
it
important.
Really is important.
And did you happen to know James Welsh by any chance?
Yes. I wouldn't say very well, but... Well,
but you did. Did your mm-hmm. past course? Well, I wondered because I worked at Hugo House and we had legacy celebration for him and in 2004.
Nice man. Yeah, I visited him a couple of times in Montana and saw him other places, and we'd end up at conferences together as writers. And then when I was at Santa Cruz, I created a Native American Literature Prize. The university was really happy to celebrate it, and they put up money for it. Obviously, the first winner was Mamede.
Oh.
And then I accepted an endowed share at the University of Oklahoma and took this prize with me, and they were happy to have it. And the first person to be recognized by the prize was Jim Welsh there.
Oh.
And he was delightful because he read some sex scenes in Oklahoma, and I thought it was perfect.
The right place.
And everybody acted very mature. And, yeah, he was a really nice man.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
and I asked him, as a writer, I asked him very discreetly to talk with me about nicknames because— You know, Winter in the Blood, such a brilliant book, and it starts with such wonderful, subtle irony. And I used to teach it this way and say, you cannot read the first paragraph and not realize that this is a wonderful, ironic journey when someone steps aside and takes a pee in a bar opit. I mean, you know you're on a playful journey here. And then the nicknames, you know, the airplane man and stuff like this. So it was that I was trying to tease, and, you know, as a writer, a fellow writer, you
what
know.
Did he...
Yeah. How about the nicknames and things? It's such because they're quite opposites. All the white guys got nicknames and the Indians don't. See, I mean, it was just a reversal. And he said, oh, I don't know. Oh, and it was just the perfect answer. He was not going to be an informant on his own book.
Right.
It was very good.
How do you feel when you're talking about your work? Do you feel...
Well, it's not so easy to talk about the work. For one thing, I am not the reader. I make this usually quite clear, and most people are surprised to hear that, the discussion, because... They think the author knows the whole thing, you know, by, you know, everything. I mean, if a few years pass and somebody wants to talk about a book, I have to read it because I've never been a reader.
Right.
I'm the writer. Now, of course, I can discuss it, but what I can discuss is how certain visions came about, certain chance connections, the excitement of discovering something both visually and contextually that I didn't know until I got into the scene of writing it. And that is such an incredibly wonderful experience. It's a creative experience that only artists really fully realize, painters, musicians, writers. And I suppose you could say, or at least for me, I kind of live for that as a writer, that mystery of finding... struggling with it, and I keep, when I start a chapter, the next day I start by rereading it to get to the point I was at. So the first parts of every chapter first few pages have been edited about a dozen times or more.
That's how you move into
it. And they change every time. Every time it changes. Mm. So you might say the least rewritten parts of any chapter are the ends of it. And, but it's such a pleasure to do this. And also, at times, embarrassing. Oh, I actually wrote that yesterday. My goodness. What could I have been thinking of? And but that's, I can talk that. But to talk about how the StoryWorks, of course, is because I don't write a formula fiction or commercial fiction. I write a... I'm not trying to be special here because people who have to write for a living must be admired, and I do. And they do their best to create an interesting, powerful story that is also meets audience expectations, and that's a kind of art in itself, or at least it's a brilliant craft. I don't do that. I frankly don't care about the commerce. I'm grateful to be published because I'm at least idiosyncratic. I am truly original in my style, and I have an objective to bring the interests and values and experience of an oral culture into print in the book. Now, I say that, and then I'll have to take a different course of discourse here and say, it can't be done. What could be done there? Nothing. Because an oral story has the familiarity of listeners. A written story is anonymous. You don't know who the reader is. The reader has to make it work. But I'm trying to work that. It's not a challenge. It's a visionary obligation to create from what I consider to be a rich and wonderful native literary imagination in stories, potential literary imagination in oral stories. And so I come with certain views. For one thing, something very basic. Good native storyers include totemic associations. There is no simile separation, like dumb as a dog, awkward as a donkey,
so a dumb dog,
bird brain, stuff like that. Almost all of our similes, I'm choosing simile, not metaphor, almost all of our similes are superior men, women over animals. Used in the reverse, to humiliate someone by saying they're less than a human, and to do that you use an animal or bird
I've
to
never
discredit
thought of
them.
That.
Well,
terrible.
So when I critique native literature, I look for that. And if a native writer is using conventional similes to separate humans from the natural world, is to me not worth reading. It's not worth reading to me because
it
isn't native.
Well, it seems disingenuous, yeah.
So I look for that. I also look for, or I try to write rather, natural motion. All natives told stories in the motion of seasons. The stories are present. And that's what I tried. And that I find a little easier because you can do that with allusions, with metaphors that open up rather than close down. And you don't go for the object. You go for a motion at the end and then jump to another sentence and start it again.
And the seasons, which brings us also to haiku.
Mm-hmm.
With their seasonal qualities, too.
Yes, I think just convenient to organize haiku poems according to seasons if they have some element of reference or some element or reference to a season.
Which you,
not that people wrote them that way, but...
But to organize them that way,
yeah,
for example.
It's easy to organize them that way. Sometimes, though, I mean, maybe about a third of my poems in this book, Favor of Crows, I didn't know where to put them. They could be in any season, but I just had to divide them up then. Here's one that was quite an early haiku of mine, and it was places sometimes are important in speaking about the poem, although a reader would have no knowledge of that. But we have the advantage we're talking about it.
Yes.
And this was waterfalls in northern Minnesota on Lake Superior. And mounds of foam beneath the waterfall float silently. So what I've done is taken this rich noise of a waterfall and then just downstream, you barely hear the waterfall. There's the foam.
And you've moved
floating
us.
Silently.
Yes.
Or this one, it's related to sound. Wooden bucket, frozen under a downspout, springs a leak. Let's see if I'll find another. Here's another sound. abandoned windmill. Who has not seen an abandoned windmill? It's a generation past, more than a generation past. Abandoned windmill, locked with rust over the well, creaks in a storm. Let's see, there's one I like here a lot.